People have used the Amazon cloud? Show of hands. How many people have used the Rackspace public cloud? Okay, everyone that just answered, put their hands up for the last two, you're Zen users, whether you know it or not. Zen is out there in many, many places, and frankly hasn't gotten a very good rep in the last while, and that's part of the reason why I'm here. But that's getting ahead of myself. So who's the fat geek up front? The guy with a big mouth. That's me. And a lot of experience in the open source world. Been a Linux user since 95. Went to a Linux desktop in 97. Did a lot of speaking inside Linux World Expo and OSCON and all these things back in the late 90s, early aughts. We call the early 2000s. I never really got a name. It's like, what? I don't know. Zero. I'm an early Linux advocate at DEC and Compaq, and wrote columns for InfoWorld and Processor, did a lot of freelance journalism. The Linux Show. How many people actually remember the Linux Show? Just show of hands. Anyone? One, two. That was one of the earliest Linux weekly webcasts. Podcasts you call them now, but they weren't called that back then. That was great fun. I was just on the Linux Link Tech Show. How many people know Linux Link Tech Show? Boy, you folks got to tune in. I go over to Linux Link Tech Show, TLLTS.org. I was on last Wednesday, this past Wednesday, you can download the podcast and everything. That's a neat, it's a neat experience because you get people talking about the stuff that they're doing and other people talking about stuff that they're doing. So, I've been around. I wrote a book that, you know, sold all it sold within like 2 weeks after Slashdot mentioned it back in 2001. I've done a lot of speaking over the years. I was really involved with open source, you know, 15 years ago, and then I went to a company that actually used open source a lot and was talking about maybe making some stuff open source but never did. And then in 2008, when the crisis hit in banking, our 11 and a half month runway turned into 3 weeks. And most of the assets and the human compatible liveware were sold off to a company that was allergic to open source. So I've been through purgatory. It's not fun. Beginning of this year, I was hired on by Citrix to be a Zen evangelist. So it's like I feel redeemed. I can actually talk again. And I actually get to work with open source again professionally. The really neat thing about my job is, you know, Citrix has some Zen products. I don't care about any of them. It's not, that's not what I'm here for. I'm here for the community and for the project. That's it. So it's actually a really cool thing to be involved with. This talk, we'll spend a little time reviewing what happened in the history of the Zen project. We'll spend some time on the history. But the big part is the bottom. There are lessons to be learned about what happened with the Zen project that can affect anyone involved in any project in open source. My job here today is to give you something to walk away with. If I don't do that, then frankly, I don't think I've done my job. So that's what we're going to take a look at here today. What's the Zen Project? How many people know what the Zen Project is? A little bit. But we'll take it. It was the premier open source hypervisor. You know, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. And we've got some of the biggest clouds, as you can see up there. Verizon TerraMark just announced a Zen-based cloud offering within the last couple of months. It's still quite solid. Linux Foundation Collaborative Project. That happened 6 weeks ago, I guess it is. Citrix, well, we'll go into the history of it, but Zen Project's now part of Linux Foundation, and you can see the list of companies that have signed on the beginning. If anyone tells you that Zen doesn't matter, take a look at that list of companies and tell me that doesn't matter. It matters to them. And chances are it's going to matter to you one way or another. So what does Zen produce? A hypervisor, number one. It's called a type 1 hypervisor. I'm not going to go into details, but basically it runs bare metal. The hypervisor's here, and then the operating systems run on top. That's not necessarily the case with a lot of hypervisors, where you have an operating system, the hypervisor runs in the kernel or on top of the kernel, and then guests run above that. It's a different theory. My boss likes to refer to it as a type 1 with a twist, because we can actually offload certain device drivers and things so that we can avoid bottlenecks. But I won't go into architecture. It also has cloud design, not only out of the box, but in its basic architecture. If you go back to the early papers, late 90s, when people were actually beginning to put together the concept of Zen, it foresaw a type of computing which we now refer to as cloud. The term cloud wasn't even being used back then. But the guys who started putting this together had the foresight to say, there's going to come a time when you're going to want that ultimate flexibility. And Zen was designed for that purpose. So even out of the box right now, the XAPI, Zen Cloud Platform, these are things that are meant to give you cloud functionality. There are other projects. If you go to the zenproject.org site, you can see stuff about the Mirage subproject and the ARM hypervisor for mobile devices. We support it in ARM on servers. There's also work coming on mobiles. Now, why would you want virtualization on mobiles? Well, you know, this thing here on my waist has more computing power in it by many times than my college did when I got my undergraduate degree. The things that would make no sense to be running a virtual system on your phone are going to be making sense, because when you start thinking of the applications for that, segmentation and so forth between maybe your business and personal phone, between other things, it's coming, we're getting ready for it. So it has a lot of bleeding edge stuff coming. But here's the 30-second story. It was first in the open source world to do what it's doing. Very high rate of adoption 10 years ago. It was the only game in town. Had some excellent technology. It even had its own corporation behind it. Zen Source was there to push itself. So it was very open source friendly. But yet 2 years ago, the state of Zen was such that by the time it would make it to this year, no one would care. Something happened to the project, despite the fact it had all the firsts, it had technology, it had position, it had the company, and yet it almost became a footnote in history. So how did it happen? The project was viable, but it forgot its connection to community. It wasn't reaching out to its users. The code development continued, but the community was stagnating. It was becoming insulated. And no one stepped up when word started getting around that's like, you know what? Zen's old hat. Zen's dying. We've got other things to concern ourselves with. And because no one stepped up, everyone started to think that was the truth. The project forgot what it was to work within an open source ecosystem. You know, we got to remember, part of what's going on here, I mean, this is what I love about these conferences. How many people have been to a closed source type of event where there's a guy standing up front wearing a suit that's more expensive than your car? And he says, "Behold, look what we have wrought." Applause, applause, applause. And it's all about the guy in the suit and a few little lackeys on stage. Open source is about you. If you're going to give applause to anyone, it's going to be to you. The guys standing up here, me and others, we're just facilitating some knowledge transfer. That's it. The work is being done by you. It's community. If we forget the community, we lose. And Zen began to forget the community. Upstream projects. Zen relies on things like what's going on in the kernel. It relies on things like QEMU. So what did it do? It started forking them. And there were patches that were not getting into the upstream. They were not becoming part of the standard distributions. What? Why? Why would that happen? Well, you know, when you're the only game in town, you'll put up and shut up, right? It takes you a little bit of work. That sort of arrogance, for lack of a better word. The project decided that the ecosystem, in this case particularly the distributions, had to do labor. How many people remember when on your distribution disk you'd have the normal kernel and then you'd have what was called a Zen kernel? Anyone remember that? And if you wanted to use Zen, you had to load the Zen kernel. Well, that's because that had all the patches in it that was going to enable the Zen experience. But that was separate from the normal kernel. And the thing is, the distributions were the ones that had to make those kernels. It's not like it was given to them. And this just went on too long. And the ecosystem began to get fed up. And so when other options came, like ABM, it's like, heck with this, we got another choice. It makes more sense and they play well with us. Also, ZenSource, open source friendly company, was sold. It was sold to a company that didn't know spit about open source. Long time closed source producer, Citrix. And the new company was interested in the technology but didn't really know what to do with an open source community. You know, it's like, what do you do with this? They weren't sure. So what happened? It wasn't about malice. It wasn't about incompetence. It wasn't about fear. It was about disconnection. It was disconnection that arose because at every point, as I've listed here, you know, it was getting disconnected from the community. It was getting disconnected from its own user base. And it was getting disconnected from the company that was supposed to be helping it along. It wasn't being integrated into anything that open source does. So 2 years ago, here's the status report. By then, the Zen hypervisor was basically overcome in the commercial market by VMware. Because VMware does what any good company will do, and that is it blows its horn. It was overcome by KVM in the open source community because they were doing it right. They remained connected to the community, and they played by the rules. The distributions got fed up, and some of them began to either not include Zen or not working to provide the services that would facilitate a Zen experience. And the community, the greater open source community itself, just began to forget. A reversal in direction occurred 2 years ago. This had to be conscious. Some of the people within Citrix management began to say, you know what? We've screwed up. We've got something important here. It's not being nurtured. And now it did one of the best things it could have done, and that is, we don't know what to do. Let's hire some people who do know what to do. So it actually began to reach out and found people who actually had open source knowledge. Brought them in and say, where do we go? And as a result of this, there's been a steady reconnection with the community. That's part of the reason why I'm here. That's why I was hired, is to get out and talk, to reconnect, to get feedback from you all. But before I even came on the scene, this was already occurring. You see, the birth of open source projects, some of which were nurtured within Citrix, you know, Apache Cloud Stack, which Joe Zonker Bronfire just talked about in the other room. So you can go back in time with your time machine and you can take that in again. Apache Cloud Stack coming out of it. The Open Daylight, which was just announced. Zen going over to Linux Foundation. Things are now being incubated more properly in an open source way. And now we've got the bug. Every once in a while, this thing goes in multiples, and it just chose to do it now. Let's try it again. 2 years ago, going to a conference like this, Lars Kurt, who's our community manager, said these are the questions he had. Zen? What's Zen? Oh, Zen, that's dead, right? That used to be an open source thing. Or is it closed source now? It's owned by that closed source company. And no one uses Zen anymore, right? That's pretty bleak. Especially in, those are words of death in the open source community. The reality today, however, is very, very different. If you're running the 3.0 kernel, it is enabled upstream for everything that you need to run Zen. Now, Zen does not, just to be clear, Zen doesn't run in the kernel, but it needs certain things to be in the kernel to be able to converse with the hypervisor. That's all there. That's been remedied. Most Linux distributions are currently Zen-enabled. The big exception, of course, is Red Hat, which made a business decision to go with KVM. Understand that. But the interesting thing there is that CentOS, which, of course, is, you know, Red Hat free, you know, sort of, kind of. The CentOS project, some people over there have decided that they're going to issue something that will allow CentOS users to actually use Zen again. And from what I just heard from one of the, is he here? I think so. One of the CentOS guys inside, you can talk to him inside, said they're probably just a few weeks away from what they'll probably release as a beta. So Zen has made a recurrence. Zen Project, now part of Linux Foundation, so no more of this stuff about it being owned by Citrix. And we've had a new, more user-friendly website, zenproject.org. As I said, for people who are late arrivers, please, if you haven't been there, go there, sign up for an account, and tell me, because I worked on it a lot, tell me if there are things you need to see there that you're not seeing. Because if you ever went to the old zen.org, it was a developer site. It looked like it was 10 years old. It looked like it's done for kernel hackers. It's not friendly. We want something that will talk to users as well as developers. So what do we learn by all this? And this is the, hopefully some of the takeaway for you. Lesson one, it's possible to die when you're winning. I mean, Zen was kind of on top of the hill. It was first. It had good tech. It had good adoption. But it almost died. It's not enough to have all those things. It's not even enough to have your own open source friendly company behind you. It had everything you could think of. So the project itself has to stay vibrant, or you can kiss it goodbye. Lesson two, disconnection from user can make you a dead project walking. You know, it's easy for us as geeks to think about the code. And we need to think about it. It's important. But if we're thinking about just the code, we can get disconnected, and suddenly those people who want the code, who want to do something with it, we don't know what it is they need. You know, the thing about open source, I get furious at times when people say, open source, it's just another means of programming. Crap. Open source is about people. about people. And I remember, just a quick spin back, 1997 Atlanta Linux Showcase. First open source conference I ever went to. 500 geeks, mostly of the fat white male variety, on a weekend in Atlanta. You looked around at the faces of these people, and they weren't there because they were being paid. They weren't there because they had some sort of grand mission from something. They were there because they actually understood that if they worked hard enough and they connected enough, they could change stuff. They could do something that would help people. You know, and I still remember the conversations. Looking into the eyes of these people, their eyes were on fire because they realized there was no one in the room to tell them no. If you've ever worked in the closed source world, you realize you get a good idea and say, yeah, that'd be cool, wouldn't it? We'll do that. And you go to the management chain and someone up the management chain says, nope, we ain't doing that. These folks figured out there's no one to say no. I'm going to go forward and I'm going to do my best. And if people use it, great. If I fall on my face, I gave it my best. But they understood it was about people. It was enabling people. And if we lose that, and this is totally aside, you know, when I started coming back into the conference scene a few months ago, I began to realize I'm not looking at the same faces I saw when I left. And I just hope, that this knowledge is being passed on to the next generation. That if this is just because you have an open source job somewhere, someone's paying you to do something with open source, then the soul of open source is going to die. We have to remember what it was here for. We have to remember it matters. People matter. And that's why open source matters. Anyway, that's entirely separate. But if you're not interacting with your users, whatever your project is, you're at risk. Also, connecting with your developers is not the same as connecting with your users. Zend was actually pretty good at keeping in touch with its developers, but it had no idea what the users wanted. They're not the same things. You need them both. So you need information sources that are good for both. The user can't come along and figure out, well, what do I need this for? How do I get started? You're in trouble if you have any maturity at all to your project. If you got to dig through the technical websites and everything just to find a simple answer, you're missing something. Connect. And even the Linux kernel development, you know, when you think about it, Linux kernel, no one in the user base talks about the Linux kernel. They're using a distribution. They're using software. But even a Linux kernel, if it ignores the stuff that trickles down to it from the user base, is going to have trouble. There is no safe place. We need to have that connection with users. Never, lesson three is never ignore your root structure. You know, open source is organic. It's living. Living things have roots. And our roots are right here in this community. The distributions, the libraries we use, all the various parts and pieces, the user groups. These things are all part of it. You can't stand alone. If your project relies on something upstream or downstream, connect, or you're at risk. Never ignore the support structure. You know, in this case, the distributions provided a lot of the basic Zend support functions. And by not connecting to them, the project began to wilt on that level. It has to be cultivated. And once more, when Red Hat decided, okay, we're going to do something different, and it bought Kubernetes, and it brought on KVM and said, this is going to be the way we're going to go, a lot of the other distributions were swayed by that. It made sense because they had someone who was playing well. Lesson five, corporate backing isn't enough. I mean, you know, this was one of those brass ring issues I remember way back when. It's like, wow, you know, if we could have someone who pay us to do open source, oh, wouldn't that just be the rush? Wouldn't that be great?
and to have the company that's standing behind you and saying, yes, we're going to do good things, that's wonderful. Except that you got to remember that even an open source friendly company has different goals in the project. They have to make some sort of profit. They've got some sort of support burden. They've got all sorts of things that are business-minded, and they have to be able to mesh. And it's not about good versus evil. It's just about two different organisms that have to work together. They have to cohabitate. They have to be partners. And so if that backing is disturbed, problems can occur. And the fact that it's an open source company is no guarantee. You know? Companies get sold. Some go on and they exist pretty well. You know, JBoss and Gluster and some of the ones that Kubernetes, you know, some of the ones that Red Hat picked up and so forth. But then you got things like, you know, MySQL. It's not really the best story in the world right now. You know, Zen went through this. I listed Cassatt because Cassatt was the company that I was with that was very open source friendly, even though, and it was consuming, and that was the one that was kept thinking about open sourcing stuff but never did. But then it was, then sold to a company that, I swear, the lawyers had a picture of Richard Stallman with a pitchfork and a tail, and they used it for a dartboard. I mean, they just loathed open source. They were scared to death of open source. And that happened in a month. So that condition can change. I mean, if you're in a project that's got an open source company behind it, that's great for now. That can change. If you get to the point where you start thinking, what would happen to our project if we didn't have this company behind us? Then this may be a time to actually start considering some of the foundation stuff, like Zonker was talking about before in an earlier session. You know, if that's what you need, if you need that company to be just like that to survive, you may be very vulnerable. So consider, you know, going to a foundation or something that can help foster your project and keep it growing. Lesson 7, there is no such thing as autopilot. You know, it's easy to rest on your laurels. It's easy to say, hey, it's always worked this way. We're good. How many people have worked for companies that said, hey, it's always worked this way. We'll just keep doing it. And then it just, especially in the IT world. You know, if you're working the same way in the IT space that you did 10 years ago, you're probably, you know, kissing the Titanic's bow right about now. I mean, it doesn't work that way in this industry. And it doesn't work this way in open source. There's no such thing as autopilot. You got to be planning for your success. Now, for a project, success isn't selling things, but it's being used. It's having input from your community. It's having a growing number of developers, etc. So you have to have some sort of plan as to what success looks like. You've got to be going for it. Don't just let it peter along. You can have great software, but if some other, particularly like, you know, big company comes in and says, you know what, we got something else we're going to push into this space. What are you going to do? Great software. I mean, if you've been inside the IT world for 10 years, you know that the best software doesn't always win. It just doesn't. Open source or not. You have to be ready for something. You have to be able to pick your position. How many people remember Windows 3.1? We'll have prayer for you later. How many people remember an IBM operating system that came along fairly well after 3.1? What was the name of it?
OS2.
It was the bomb.
It was the bomb and it exploded. But once again, it's like, which one was more technically superior?
Those two by a long shot.
Yes. The dang thing ran. Which one won in our space?
Windows 3.1.
OS2 ran, provided you have hardware that had drivers that supported it and you had beefing up hardware.
Let's not be picky. But this is the thing. Best doesn't win. You need something more than that.
There's actually OS2 still running today. It runs a lot of ATMs.
Yep. I remember seeing that not too long ago.
Maintains it and offers commercial support that isn't IBM.
Yes.
So if you own an ATM, step into it.
But the lesson is still there. This industry has never been about the best software wins. So if you have good tech, and Zen had good tech, it's not going to be enough necessarily. You have to have everything else in place. If it ain't growing, it's dying. Once again, organic model, but it's true. If it's not moving and growing, it's dying. So if your project isn't seeing new blood, get a little worried and get some new blood. Why is that important? Growth, but the other thing is perspective. You heard that inside the keynote this morning. How many of you read the keynote? I hope all of you. You know, you need perspective, a change in perspective. You don't want to get ingrown. Organisms have to move and grow, and new folks are part of that picture. Know where your project could fit in the world and make a plan to get there. You know, it's in the early days of open source, the race was on to cover ground. You know, we didn't have a good GUI, so people worked on a GUI. We didn't have a good this, so people ran to do this. And so there was generally, there was like one or two, and there was one that sort of emerged the leader and frequently had some adoption right away. Because it was the first one to get the job done. That is not open source today. Open source today, there's going to be competition, and there's going to be certain areas where one thing makes sense and other areas where a different thing makes sense. So you have to start making the concept in your mind, okay, I've got this really neat stuff, and it answers certain user problems. What are those problems? Where's it going to fit? It's not going to be one size fits all, probably. Because even if you're first, and you're the first one to think of this really cool thing, chances are 2 years from now, you're going to be in a horse race. 2-3 others, maybe. Where do you fit better? Part of what's going on inside the Zen world right now, KVM uses a different type of hypervisor. It's not a question of one's better. They're different. One's type one, one isn't. One's kernel-centric. They have different properties. They have different uses. VirtualBox. You know, how many people use VB? Wonderful little thing where you want to spin up an alternate desktop, you know, because your company's got to have a Windows desktop, and so we're going to shove it on this thing here because there's a little goofy little program that's got to run, you know, so you can whoop it onto the desktop and you can do your thing. And you can shut it down and get some real work done. But real quick and easy, you know, to just kind of boot it up and go and get things done and so forth. Great for the one thing, the two thing. Imagine managing 1,000 of them. Just think of what the desktop looks like, managing 1,000 virtual items. It's not the use case. It's not the fit. Does that mean the software's no good? No, the software's fine for the proper use case. So we have to be thinking about with our projects, you know, where do I fit? What's the problem I solve? Not just in general terms, in specific terms. Who's going to be there? Why? How big is it going to be? These are the questions we should be asking ourselves. So you need to figure out who your users are. You need to talk to them to find out what they really need and make a plan to get there. Because there's always room for improvement. Lesson 10, competition increases innovation. Man, you know, I've had people say, oh gosh, you know, you Zen guys must hate KVM. Why the hell would we hate KVM? Iron sharpens iron, especially in the open source world. It's not about who gets to the top of the hill and becomes the mega monster masher, you know, who owns it all, kind of like, you know, the Microsoft sort of concept. We don't have to go there. But when you have competition between open source projects, innovation occurs because it's like, well, we can do something better than that. Oh, we'll look at it this way. And the other one said, yeah, well, we'll look at it this way, and we'll do something better over here. And it keeps pushing the ball along. You know, as an aside, too, if you're working closed source, I don't know, you know, if you're working with a closed source cloud, I have no idea why. God help you. Because if you look at what's going on in the cloud world, so much of the innovation is going on here in the open source world. Why? Because it has to constantly change. It's got to be constantly thought. It's got to constantly move. There's so much innovation going on here. And it's because there are competing technologies. There are competing thought streams. People are trying to do something better. How many people remember CDE, the Common Desktop Environment? Real slow on the hands, guys. You don't want to admit it. We're all trying to pound that down and say, oh, God, no, don't do that. CDE, you know, was the Unix desktop back in the days of the grand Unix wars. I heard a story. So I knew one of the guys who was one of the principals of X11, Jim Geddes. And one of the engineers at DEC, when I was working at DEC, worked alongside Jim on certain things. And he said, you know, when Jim and the other guys were working on the X window system, he said, they poured their heart and soul. They wanted something that was going to be flexible, going to be powerful, going to do all sorts of great stuff. And then, standards, okay, standards is a good thing. The standard of CDE. And it was so mundane. It smelled of mundane. It was just, for people who didn't work with it, it was just a miserable sort of thing. And Jim, who has this infectious laugh, I mean, he can light up a room like nothing when you get him laughing, man. He has this infectious laugh. And my friend Jay said, you know what? Jim lost his laugh. He had poured his heart and soul for years into getting X right, giving it the power they could do something wonderful. And all they came up with was CDE. He said sometime later, you know, Jim had gone on to other things. And then sometime later, someone brought him a Linux disk. And it was at the time when GNOME and KDE were rocking it out, you know. And they said, hey, Jim, have you seen what they're doing with your X system these days? I said, what? So he plugged it in and started showing. He said Jim got his laugh back. Because they were starting to do what he had always hoped. You know, we get this thought where we can just standardize or just sort of keep it on even plane. No, we got to fight for innovation. And that means that we got to go toe-to-toe sometimes with people who think differently than us. So you've got a competitor, great. You're going to move forward. So you got to keep it going. KVM, VMware, make sure that virtualization is going forward, because now we're in a nice three-way fight, along with other things. Lesson 11, this is sort of a subtle one. If you've got an established project and you've got some good stuff, make sure you're releasing new stuff, good stuff, periodically. Why? Because otherwise people start to think, well, you're done. You're old hat. You know, they got Hypervisor, what else is there? Well, there's a whole lot else to talk about. That's part of what I'm here for, to talk about. We got all sorts of stuff out there, you know, all the ARM stuff that's going on, the Mirage stuff. Mirage stuff is really weird. Teeny, tiny, highly efficient little VMs that, you know, can just do all sorts of possibilities. It's really neat. Go to the website, take a look. If you're not making headway and people aren't aware of it, you could be in trouble. It doesn't matter whether or not you really are. You gotta let people know. So those advances are gonna keep the project rolling. And sometimes perception really is reality. That's a real hard one for hardcore geeks to understand sometimes. We think in terms of the bits and bytes. It's either there or it's not. It works or it doesn't. Well, you know, there are times when if someone thinks it's a piece of crap, it's a piece of crap. That perception has to be managed. You have to reach out and you have to be talking to people. You know, if rumors arise that you're outdated, you're outmoded, you're not doing anything, you got to speak up. You got to show your hand a little bit, because unchallenged lies become accepted as truth. I live outside of Washington, D.C. It's true. After a quarter century, it doesn't matter what the party is in office, it's true. You know, and we have to, as geeks, we have to understand it. You want something to be vibrant. Counterpoint to this, just look at what Red Hat and KBM did, you know, and IBM. When they bought PumaNet, and they said, we're going to focus on this KBM stuff, I still remember from way back then, seeing some rumbles in the community saying, well, what's Red Hat going to do? Is this a power play? But, you know, the thing is, they did it right. They did it right. KVM became a reasonable, and always was, but it stayed a very reasonable entity within the open source world. And any sort of qualms that were developing pretty much just folded away. Because everyone played by the rules, and they did it right. We have to play by the rules. And so as a result, you know, Red Hat, IBM, both of which had real money in the game, they can reap the rewards because they played the game right. Here's a crash course in perception management. I'm not going to go through all of this. Okay, good. I won't go through all of this thing. You can see the slide. The slides, by the way, are up on the Linux Fest website. I put them up there like a day ago. They'll also be available from zenproject.org. Probably in a couple of days. Well, the old version is, but yeah, the one I did from the Linux World Northwest, pretty close. But you know, we got to think of things like submit talks. You're working on a project, talk about it. Submit talks to places like this. Great place to be. It's like, I don't know how many times I've heard, you know, geeks say, "Well, I don't like talking." Well, you know, if you can handle calculus, you can handle talking. Talking is easy. You learned it when you were 5. Calculus is hard. Engineering is hard. It's actually not that bad. Just as an aside, too, one of the things I remember from the early days, I think it was like 99, maybe, the old Linux Expo, not the Linux World Conference and Expo, but the old Linux Expo that Red Hat used to fund in North Carolina. Miguel de Casa, how many people were... No, Miguel. God, I'm feeling old. Miguel de Casa, who was big in a lot of things, GNOME being one at the time. He had the major presentation at a show not unlike this one. So everyone's crammed into this theater to hear Miguel's talk. And I mean people standing up against the wall the whole 9 yards, waiting with bated breath. Miguel had his laptop, which was made for the Mexican market. Well, for whatever reason, that Mexican market laptop didn't want to work with the projectors. They could not get it to display. On top of it, that was his notes for the talk, for the slides, so he couldn't see what he was going to talk about. So what did he do? And I'm not sure, I'm pretty sure Miguel is more comfortable working in Spanish than English on top of this, just to add a little sauce to the mix. He stood up for an hour, and the audience was riveted. Worked without notes, without slides. He just spoke from here. He told people what he knew. And at that moment in time, a revelation hit me. Presentation isn't about wearing a good suit and having great slides and, you know, some little rubber dolly type personoid up there going, la, 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 la. In fact, open source people have a great advantage because we believe what we're talking about. Let it out. Let it out. I still remember the first job I was ever in, VP of sales. I was coding at the time, closed source company. We didn't know what open source was back then. God, the Earth's surface had just cooled recently. And the VP of sales told me, you know what? When you're showing me the new features of the new release, I want you to make sure that I believe this is great. If you can get me convinced that I'm doing a disservice if I let my customer buy from the other guy, because we got better and they will do better with us than with them, there's going to be a look in my eye, a sound in my voice that will let them know that I'm speaking the truth. And that matters. And that rang true for me that day more than anything else, to see this man just stand up, wing it for an hour, and standing ovation when he was done. I have seen the best presentations in my professional career from open source people. Period. If you don't think you can talk, chances are it's because you haven't tried. Try it. What's the worst that can happen? Someone's not going to like you. Get on a mailing list and say something controversial about lots of people who don't like you. You're used to that, you know? Say it. Say it. Let it leak. Let your intensity leak out. Don't worry about whether you've got the silk suit or any of that garbage, you know? I mean, I was talking with Joe earlier. I came to the conclusion a long time ago that I wasn't going to pump too much into my slides when I do a talk, because if I put together a bunch of slides that any rubber dolly can recite to me, you're going to get up and you're going to look like a rubber doll. No, let it come from here. And that's something that we've got in spades. In spades. We believe what we're doing. If you don't believe what you're doing, you've got a problem in open source. Simple as that. Let it leak. You know, there's a bunch of cheap stuff. Borg booths. You know, stuff that's going on out here. You think this is big money that's going on out here? You know, in most of these regional conferences, they'll either won't charge at all, or, you know, you got to pay $50 or something, you know. Have a car wash, for crying out loud. You know, get yourself an org booth. Get yourself a few flyers that describe the stuff that you're doing if it's a small little project. Bumper stickers, you know, little business cards. You got the Vistaprint, you know, you can get 7 million of them for $10 or whatever. You know, do it. Just get the word out. It's not that difficult. Volunteer to talk. Learn. You know, I mean, if you're going to screw up, you might as well screw up in front of your friends. Seriously. Where do we learn anything, you know? The thing is, we're here with community. We're not here with customers. We're all in this together. Remember, do it. Shout your mouth off. Blogs. Talk about cheap thrills. Everyone's got a frickin' opinion. And if you've been on a mailing list, you've used it a lot, probably. So put it in a blog. Make it document what stuff that you're doing is. Simple. A usable website. Once again, not rocket science. It's one of the other, I think it was Joe's talk just now. I'm quoting from you a lot, Joe. You know, if you suck at websites, chances are you've got a skill that some other project could use. So pitch in and help them with their problem, then say, oh, by the way, can you kind of like paste together a website for me, please? There you go. You know, Joomla in 3 hours, and suddenly you're looking fit. Podcasts, you know, the Linux Link Tech Show. Listen to them, for crying out loud, you do nothing. But I mean, if those guys are good, just send them an email saying, you know what? Look at this project I'm doing over here. Do you mind if I come on just for 10 minutes? Let me talk about it. Chances are, if you look legit at all, they'll say, yeah, come on, let's talk. If you do a good job, you can go back on another, you know, few weeks and talk about the new stuff you're doing. They like it because they want stuff that has to do with us. And it doesn't cost a thing. Social media, of course, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Yeah, go ahead. Shoot your mouth out. You know, do something. Talk about what you're doing. YouTube demos and tutorials. Big stuff once you actually get to users. And you think, who needs that? Well, guess what? Users like it.
Give them something that they can do in 10 minutes. Press the socks off. Got a kick-ass little mascot. You can't do it hard. And just bottom line is, shout out and live, or shut up and die. That's kind of what we're doing here, you know? Talk about the stuff you're doing. You know what? Other story. Some of the early shows inside the late 90s. You'd go, and there'd be the bar after party or the night thing, you know. And you go there, and there's everyone walking around with a beer in their hands. No one ever got drunk. Why? Because they were too busy talking. You can't get drunk if you're never lifting the cup to your lips. I mean, I can remember very much, you know, spending 3-4 hours at these after conference events, and you're just talking and talking, and people are coming up to you, and it's people you've never met before, and say, "What do you do?" "Oh, I got this thing, you know, here's what we're doing." And you're explaining everything. There's no time for stupidness. Just want to talk about the code. You know, we have to remember that we can talk about what matters to us. Do it. Just do it. A couple last of them will be done. The corporate connection. This is important because how many people here, you are in a job that in some way, shape, or form facilitates something you're doing in open source? Either they're paying you to use it, they're paying you to write it, they're paying you to do something with it. You know, when I first started in this adventure, that was the brass ring, man. Oh, someone actually paying me to do this? God, that's wonderful. Now, you take a look at some of these big projects, you know, you've got all these corporate emails, and you can watch the pie charts. You know, it's like there's a lot of corporate work going on, but you need to have a grip on what your corporate world needs and what your project world needs. You have to get that right, and that's something that you can't get disconnected from. You've got to manage the relationship between business and the project, and this is the Citrix problem. You know, if it looks like it's owned, as other people have mentioned, Oracle. If you got a project that looks like owned by a company, people lose enthusiasm. Imagine that. So you got to get that relationship right. And the perception really is dangerous if it's not handled right. It's a symbiotic relationship, and you can end up with fake open source. And I'm thinking of an open source portal that I used in my last job. Was open source, quote unquote. You get the software. Try to hire someone to work on that portal who didn't have current or past badge of the company behind it was impossible. They had no community. The community was their company. There's a problem. That's what I consider fake open source. You don't want to get there. So final thoughts. Is your code good? You're reaching out to your users. Your development community active and engaged. You're reaching out to the rest of the community regardless of what you're doing. Do you have proper support? And do you have the freedom to do what you need to do separate from your corporate interests? Are you getting the user feedback you need to know whether or not you're doing the job right? And is the project identity getting lost inside some corporate haze? Bottom line, whatever you do, don't give up. Don't give up. It matters too much. If you feel like you're on the road, it's time to change the road. Send hate mail there. Go to zenproject.org. We got 1 minute for questions. Questions.
Do you think it's healthier for most open source projects to be part of a foundation or to be part of a corporation?
I think it's healthier for them to have whatever is the appropriate relationship. And that, unfortunately, takes some figuring out. Like I said, the big thing is, whatever it is, it can't be owned by a company. It may be facilitated, but it can't be owned. So sometimes foundation's a good thing, excellent thing. But a lot of
smaller efforts, particularly if the company's got, you know, skin in the game, fine. Just make sure that relationship between the two entities is managed. Don't let it go on autopilot. And don't just say, well, you just do your own thing. That was kind of the Citrix thing. It's like, well, we don't know what to do with these guys. We'll let them do whatever they want. That's no good. Because there's no relationship. You need the relationship or you lose it.
Like a decent example of a project that's done pretty well under corporate stewardship is KVM.
Yeah, Red Hat's very good at at making sure that their open source projects remain open source projects. Regardless, they've got a good model. Joe.
Point of order, KVM is in the kernel.
True.
So that's not, I mean, Red Hat has done good things by KVM, but it's not like they're running the entire show. And that's
part of that has been getting it into the kernel.
Was it KVM in the kernel when they bought Quant or whatever?
QRAMnet?
QRAMnet, yeah.
I remember the history of little data
in
that area.
It was in the kernel. It was the kernel of virtual machine, so by definition it was in the kernel. That's how it started.
Other questions before we close? I want to thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you all being here. I hope you have a great finish on the show.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.